And I wanted to welcome all of you to yet another Spark webinar. Today's webinar is being led by Dr. Eileen Ernenwein from East Tennessee State University. She's someone who we've worked with for a long time at CAST. She, in fact, used to be a researcher at CAST. And I'm going to hand it over to her at this point, and she's going to be talking to us today about archaeological geophysics and how you make good choices about using this really diverse and I don't think we can say anything stronger than extremely useful suite of techniques in archaeological research. Just one administrative note, during the lecture, if you're not talking, we're going to ask you to mute your mic. If you do want to talk, you see the little button where you can see my face and Eileen's face right now. Just below that, you'll see a talk button. You have to push the talk button with the little microphone on it if you want to ask the question. Or you can also ask questions using the chat window to the whole room, and we will be monitoring the chat window, which is just above the audio video box on the left-hand side of your screen, and we will either answer those questions as we go or at the end of the session, depending on how it fits into the flow of things. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Eileen.
Okay, thank you, Rachel, and thanks for having me. I am going to talk about, I have this talk kind of geared toward people that are not very familiar with the methods, really have the questions about, can I do geophysics at my site, which methods might be useful, the things to think about to make that decision and start to move forward on maybe doing some geophysics. I will try to monitor the chat box, and if I see questions, if they fit in, I'll try to fit them in. If they don't, just we'll save them till the end. Or if I don't, I don't want to get off track too much, so I'll just keep an eye on those. So let me go ahead and get started. So as Rachel said, I am still affiliated with CAST. I'm a assistant professor at East Tennessee State University. See if I can get my there it goes. Okay. So I first want to go over some really fundamental. Some of the fundamental concepts in archaeological geophysics, because I can't really discuss, there's just some terminology, some background you need to know, some really important things that people may not think of. The first is that you can kind of divide the technologies into passive sensors, which are methods that, passive sensors are sensors that are just listening. So the only sensor that I use that's truly passive that I use usually is a magnetometer, and it is measuring the Earth's magnetic field. It's not generating its own signal, it's just listening, it's just measuring what's present. The other sensors that I use are active sensors, and they are generating their own signal, and they're putting it into the ground. So GPR is sending radio waves into the ground, electromagnetic induction is generating an electromagnetic field and propagating into the ground, and resistivity is actually injecting an electrical current in the ground. So those are all active methods. Another example of a passive method would be any kind of satellite remote sensing. Well, not any kind, but multispectral imagery and thermal, which has become kind of a renewed interest in that lately. So another concept is that we have, for anyone who has a background in GIS or has seen some GIS, a little bit familiar, you've got raster data and vector data. All imagery is raster data, so it's made up of a whole bunch of cells. So is a digital photograph. If you take an image, it's made up of little tiny squares. So that's raster data. Different from vector data, which is points, lines, and polygons, treated completely differently in the computer. So everything in geophysics, even when it looks more like a blobby image, it looks smooth. It's, if you zoom in, it's all pixel-based. One of the things that's really important for geophysics and remote sensing in general is that you have two important concepts. One is that one thing to consider, and I'll say the word a lot, is contrast. So objects, if you're looking at imagery, remote sensing imagery of any kind, to be able to see it, you have to have contrast. So on this scale here, from high contrast is at the bottom, you see high contrast, you can see that white circle. And then down up at the top is low contrast. such a low contrast that you can't see it. So the contrast is the magnitude, the difference between the anomaly or the feature you're trying to see and the surrounding values. So the relative difference between those targets. And the other thing to consider is noise. So we have a couple different types of things that we would refer to as noise in geophysical data. Basically, when I say noise, I mean that this is as unwanted, random sort of spikes or signals in the data. So what you might call static, with electromagnetic methods like radar, it's interference from cell phones and radio signals. It is errors that we make while collecting data, or sometimes a spike, an erroneous measurement by the instrument. So those are unwanted signals or noise, and on that scale on the right, you can see that it's the same scale bar as we talked about with contrast, but it's got this added speckly pattern on it. And that's the noise added to it, and that makes it even harder to see. So it kind of masks the features. So those are two of the things to consider with when we talk about the quality and the ability to really see something. Another word that I will use and that my colleagues use is clutter. And clutter is a type of noise, but we distinguish it from that sort of staticky noise. Clutter is when you have things in your data that are, they're real and they're probably there in the ground most of the time, but they're not what we're looking for. So if you're an archaeologist, you're looking for archaeological features. You're not looking for buried pipelines, other things that are in the environment that are not of interest to you, and they get in the way. So any unwanted signals like rodent burrows, those are a big problem in some areas, tree roots, geological layers, it may, you know, that may be cutting into things or obstructing things. Metal debris is a big problem with magnetometry, and I'll talk about this image in a second. Even lightning strikes will generate a signal in magnetometry. So this is everything that's not archaeology that we don't really want to see. And so in this image here, the black and white line is delineating the area where archaeologists at this site went out and they walked around and did a surface survey, and they put pin flags in the ground where they found artifacts. So those pin flags were left and then over time fell down and became scattered all over the surface. So this magnetometry survey is showing you nothing more than a scattering of pin flags. So it's showing you the impact of archaeology using metal pin flags. So it's a problem, and that's what I would call recent metal clutter is in that image there. If it wasn't there, we might have been able to see some prehistoric features, but the metal is so strong of a signal, a magnetic signal, that it really gets in the way of everything else. And so what we see in this image is where archaeologists marked artifacts mostly. Okay, so a couple more terms that I'll use. One is data density, and that just means when you're collecting data, the number of readings that you take every meter. So you're walking along in a line with a sensor, and you're logging something every half meter or every 10 centimeters or something like that. So that's data density. And so this image kind of shows up here in this region is high data density, because you've got more points per meter or per unit area, and then down here is a lower data density. You could call it resolution, although resolution has a lot of different meanings. So that leads into this this next concept. The word resolution is kind of thrown all over the place. Really, and if you can generalize, it means it's the ability to resolve detail. But really, it can mean a lot of things. So people will use it for data density. Or if you can be saying, what is the resolution of the sensor? What is its ability to detect certain things? That's also resolution. So the word is very general. If you want to be more specific, you can say spatial resolution. The spatial resolution of the data is what I call, to be more clear, I call it data density or sampling density. So that's how many, you know, points did you collect along each line per unit area. But you may also be referring to the resolution of the sensor, the second point. So the size of the objects that can be detected, you might refer to that as the sensor resolution. How small of something can you see? So that's the kind of the limitations of the sensor. And then you can also talk about the resolution of the recording device. So you may have a very high, very sensitive instrument, but the data logger you're using may be rounding it to the nearest whole number, and that then you're losing your precision. So the precision of the recorded values and how accurately and precisely you record those values is another resolution type. And then one final point about resolution, when you if you're talking about any imagery or remote sensing, aerial photos, or geophysical data, you may ask what is the resolution, and that is usually what is the size of each pixel. So maybe it's half meter resolution. But what happens is you want to know the original resolution, because somebody then may take it and interpolate and improve the decrease the size of the pixels, and in that case, it's not really improving the resolution, it's just smoothing it out. So the original, the way it was collected, is the true resolution. After that, it's data processing, and you can't get more out of it once you've collected it. So you cannot really improve resolution after you've collected data. So when you are collecting data, the strategy that you decide to use is really important, and the way that you configure your instrument and the way that you collect it are really important. Okay, so some of the broad principles in archaeological geophysics. So geophysics is something that's used in a lot of different realms, but in archaeology, we're looking at subsurface features, and they don't have to have a surface expression. So unlike aerial imaging, where you're looking at crop marks, you're looking at differences in vegetation and soils, you don't need that. You can have a completely homogeneous looking surface because you're looking what's beneath the surface. With geophysics, you really want to collect data over a large contiguous area. Small, tiny areas of data collection are often hard to interpret because you really need the broader picture to see kind of the broader patterns of what's going on. And you need contrast. So I kind of define the word contrast. So if you're thinking about your site and can you do geophysics, one of the first questions I would ask you is what is the type of feature that might be there, and what is it like compared to the surroundings? So is there enough contrast? Is it different enough? Then it might be able to be detected, and then we can talk about what those properties are. It's also limited to pretty shallow depths. So some people are looking really deep. It's really limited with going down deep. So the closer to the surface, the better. As you go down, you can use different configurations, different instruments, but you're still going to lose that ability with depth. So a really big monumental site, deeply buried, may work because it's so the architecture may be so big and pronounced. But a paleo site buried 3 meters down on a river floodplain is not going to find it with the typical geophysical methods. And then finally, multiple methods are always better than one. I almost never use just one instrument. I have three. I have GPR, magnetometry, and EM. And I will always want to use at least two of them because they measure different properties and they can complement each other and make a better picture of what you're looking at. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through some of the main methods, the ones that I use, the ones that most archaeological geophysics people use. And I'm just going to go through pretty systematically these five questions for each method. And those questions are, number one, what property is measured? So for each technique, what are we actually measuring? The fundamental property that we are exploiting in order to measure archaeological features. And then how is it measured? So how is this instrument actually doing it? Sort of the theory, real briefly. I'm not going to get into detail about it. And then I'll talk a little bit about different configurations of the instrument, how it's actually sort of put together to generate and measure signals. And then the limitations, depth and resolution is a big question for everybody, and advantages and disadvantages of each method. So for electrical resistance, I start with this one because it is one of the oldest methods in archaeology, and it is the most basic in terms of how it works. It's pretty basic electrical stuff. So what property is measured? You're looking at just the ability of the material in the ground to pass electrical current. So it's measured in ohms. You may have used an ohm meter at home to test a circuit. You're just taking an electrical current, running it through the ground, and then seeing how strongly you're measuring it at another location. So it's strongly related to moisture. As you know, water conducts electrical currents. So resistivity is going to be greatly improved by enough moisture contrast. So if the features, the archaeological features, tend to hold more moisture than the surrounding material, then you have a better chance of seeing it with this sort of instrument, with electrical resistance. This is a picture of one. There's many different configurations, but this is a resistivity meter that's used often in archaeology. And so down here, you can see my arrow, right? Rachel, do you see my arrow? Oh, you probably have your mic.
Yes, I see the arrow.
Okay, thank you. So you've got the spikes going into the ground, so the current is going into the ground through these. Actually, it's being measured through those spikes. So here's an example of a cemetery in the lower left there where the graves are detected, and probably because they tend to hold a little bit more moisture and the conditions were just right when that data were collected. You may go back to that cemetery another time after a long period of dry weather, and it may not show up at all. So because you have the right amount of moisture contrast, so sometimes it's a matter of timing. And the big data set over here is a World War I era city in Kansas called Army City. And you can see the street pattern pretty well here. And then this is concrete building structure. So it's mostly gone, but the signature is still there in the ground. So resistivity is great for measuring, really precisely measuring things like walls that are rock architecture. In this case, it's concrete. Over here on this side, you see these little dots. Those are all the footers of a building. So the building is gone, but the footers are there. So it can be a really, really useful method for all types of sites, not just historic. This just happens to be a good example that I had. The way it's measured, you know, the theory behind it is just very simply it's Ohm's law. So resistivity is the voltage divided by the current. And that's basically it. So you're passing the current through the ground and you're measuring it with a voltmeter. That's what the resistivity instrument really is. And you can build one. You can find instructions online and get everything you need from Radio Shack to go out and do resistivity. It's just that it won't be so optimized with a data logger unless you're good at computer programming. So that's the theory behind it. And here's sort of a schematic showing you what is going on in the ground. So if you've ever seen somebody collect resistivity data, they have an instrument, maybe one like this with two probes, or maybe several probes in the ground. But what you have is you have an instrument set up like this, and there are lots of options for how to configure that. The most common is the twin probe array, and that's what, I mean, almost all archaeologists use that, but there's other ways that you can arrange it. But the twin probe array, it just has a current and a potential sampler here, and the current and potential remote probes somewhere far away. So you're actually walking around with this meter, and you're tethered by these long electrical wires. And so they are the current probes are creating this constant current in the ground, and then the potential probes are just sampling it as you move along. And then you have to have long cables so that you can always have, you have to be 30 times your probe spacing away. So details that may not be, you know, that critical unless you're trying to do this. But you got to be some distance away. So the management of that in the field can be a little bit cumbersome. With electrical resistance, your depth in the ground, it's dependent on your probe spacing. So in that last slide, two slides up here, there's three probes, one here, and one here, and they are 50 centimeters apart. So it's measuring two data sets, it's collecting two lines of data at once at 50 centimeters apart. So as you move those probes farther apart, you're going to look down deeper. So you're targeting, the closer the probes are together, the shallower the depth that you're targeting. So for the twin probe array, you have the mobile probe separation, the two of them that are on that frame that you're walking around with. And that's where the measurement is focused. So if you look at this graphic down here at the bottom, this is a hypothetical, theoretical situation where you have an archaeological feature, like this one here. And this is maybe a pit feature, or in cross-section it's a wall trench or a ditch. And if you had your probe separated 50 centimeters, so you're targeting a depth of 50 centimeters, then if the feature was shallow, like an A here, then that would be perfect because you were targeting about the right depth. And so your anomaly, your magnitude of your measurements when you're over that feature would be good and strong, a good measurement. If you were doing a survey and the same exact feature was underground, but you had spaced your probes apart a meter or more, you would be targeting a deeper area. You'd be targeting down here. When I say targeting, it's kind of the where it's concentrated, but it's actually sensitive to around, above it, and below it too. But you're spreading out your measurement. So you're spreading out the whole area in light gray is what you're taking kind of an average measurement of. So you might still see this feature because it's shallow, but the magnitude of your measurement represented by this this high here, this signal, is going to be lower. So if you use the wrong probe separation, you're losing your ability to detect the feature. So the closer together, it's better. However, if you look at C, if your situation is that you think your features are much deeper and you put your probes too close together, then you may miss it entirely. So in this case, if it's deeper, your only hope is to measure something, is to increase the probe separation so you can target that depth. In this case, you'll have a very small anomaly, but that is your only hope if it's down that deep, because if you put your probes close together, you'll miss it. So you have to target that depth, and you know that, as I said, resolution is compromised with greater depth in the ground. So this is a graphic for resistivity, but it's the same thing for electrical conductivity, which I'll mention real briefly in just a second. So the advantage is electrical resistance, it's a really reliable method. It works really well as long as you have moisture contrast. You can target those different depths, which is great. So most of them you don't really have so much of a choice at the depth that you're targeting, but with resistivity data, you really do. And you can change that probe separation to achieve that. And it's not influenced by things like metal pin flags, which magnetometry is, or you've got trash, shell casings, bottle caps, things on the ground that are metal. They're going to be a problem for other methods, particularly magnetometry, but not for resistivity. So this is an option for sites that have that sort of thing. The disadvantages are that electroresistivity is pretty slow. You're moving, you got to pick that big thing up and put it in the ground for every single point. So you're moving along at a pretty slow pace, and other methods have gotten a lot faster, and this one nobody's made it any faster. Besides, there are some people that are using a wheeled sort of an ATV, and the probes are actually in the wheels, and so it's constantly collecting data as it goes along. That has not become widely used, and it's very expensive, and it requires that you have conditions with which you can pass over with a ATV, which for many sites that I work at is not possible. But if you're working in a golf course type terrain, it's perfect, and it would be something to consider for sure. So the disadvantages, it is generally slower, lower data density. Because you're going so slowly, you might want to pick that up and put it back down every half meter, and that's pretty coarse data. That's not as high resolution as some of the other data sets. You have to insert the probes. So if you have very hard surface cover, if you have very hard pan soils or dryness, then you can't stick the probes in the ground and you can't collect data. So you need it to, it won't work in the desert. I've tried it. There has to be some moisture in the ground. And then also for traveling, it's kind of a bulky instrument. So I have never taken it, I have traveled with it overseas. It's very cumbersome, but I don't usually. Okay, so that's resistivity. Another instrument that, another method is electromagnetic induction, EMI, sometimes just called EM. This is a reminder slide. I'm going through those five things for most of these methods. What's measured? How is it measured? How is it configured? and the advantages and disadvantages. So what are we measuring with this instrument? Well, the electromagnetic induction instrument is measuring two things. It's measuring conductivity. It's got two independent data sets. Conductivity, which is how easily the electrical current flows through the material. That is the inverse of resistivity, theoretically. So you would think, by this description, that you're getting exactly the same thing as you would with a resistivity meter. But it's different. It's using electromagnetic fields instead of direct electrical currents. The data are sometimes very different. So it's really not. But sometimes it is. So it just depends on the data set, the moisture, and things like that. The EMI instrument also measures magnetic susceptibility, which is the ability of something to become magnetized. So this is an active sensor. It's generating an electromagnetic field. It's going in the ground, and then the response is an electromagnetic field that's generated as a response to that primary field. That's in my next slide. And so you're measuring both of the electrical component and the magnetic component. Electromagnetic induction measures both of those things. So here are two instruments that measure. Those are two EMI instruments from Geonyx. The one on the left is the EM31, and it is this really long boom. So there's a transmitter on the front end and a receiver on the back end. This one here is not as often used in archaeology because it's looking a lot deeper. It's good for measuring earthworks and things like that. It's been used a lot by one of my colleagues, Renita Dalen, at Cahokia, and some big earthwork things. So good for measuring that. Usually what I use is the EM38, which is another instrument by the same manufacturer. And this one has a transmitter in the front and a receiver in the back. So how it's working, this diagram here is kind of showing your transmitter, T, right here, is generating the field. And then it's going into the ground. And when it encounters a feature like this pit feature here, then the properties of that material respond to it, and you get what are called eddy currents. And they make a secondary magnetic field. So it's like the response to the initial field that's generated right there. And then that field is measured at the receiver. So you're measuring the response of things in the ground to the electromagnetic field. And you're recording both conductivity and magnetic susceptibility at the same time. So it's really a great instrument and a great way of getting two data sets at once. The advantages of EMI, you're doing, like I said, two things at once. It's going to work where resistivity does not, because the instrument here is just, it's being passed along over the ground, but there's no inserting probes in the ground. In fact, this picture right here is at Tiwanaku, and it's a very dry climate in the winter when we're there. And so we could not do resistivity very effectively there because the probes go in the ground and it's so dry. So places that are really dry, you can pass over anything with the EM, and it doesn't depend on that soil moisture. It's more portable. You know, it's in a case that you can use, one checked bag on an airplane, or stick it in the back of the pickup or something. It's pretty easy to bring around compared to a resistivity meter. And the MS data that you get is, it's a different data set than you get with a magnetometer, which I'll get to next. It's sometimes more sensitive, so sometimes you see things with MS data that you do not see with a magnetometer. So it's a really great sensor. I like to use it at many sites. The disadvantages for the resistivity, for the conductivity data, it's a little bit less precise than the resistivity. So if you were to compare two data sets, resistivity and conductivity, usually what I see is the conductivity is like a little bit more averaged out. It's kind of a broader sensing pattern. So resistivity is sometimes better resolution results. And then with the MS data, you're actually having, it doesn't go down as deep in the ground. So lower, less depth penetration with this instrument than with a magnetometer. So you have that too to consider. All right, magnetometry is probably the second, geophysical method that became widely used after resistivity, and it's kind of the workhorse of archaeology for archaeological geophysics. So with magnetometry, first thing we're going to talk about is the depth and the resolution. So So you're going to, the only features you're going to detect with a magnetometer are those that have some sort of magnetic property, obviously. So the depth, the ability to detect things, there's a lot of factors here. Let me slow down. So the first thing is that it's going to depend on their magnetic properties and the distance away from the sensor. So you're carrying your magnetometer along the surface, and if it's close enough and if the field, the magnetic properties of that feature are strong enough, then you'll be able to see it and map it. You cannot just configure it to target a specific depth. You don't have that ability. You're just limited by the sensitivity of the sensor. The depth with a magnetometer is usually ballpark 1 to 2 meters, but that is really just an average, because really the depth, it depends on the feature that you're looking at. Strongly magnetic features, very deeply buried, could be easily mapped because they're so strong. So you're going to be looking deeper if you have some big massive feature or very strongly magnetic feature. The rule here is that the strength of the magnetic field is decreasing with the third power of distance. In other words, it's exponentially decreasing. So as you're looking at deeper and deeper archaeological features, the ability for the magnetometer to detect those is going to be exponentially lost. For example, if you had a feature that was 1 nanotesla, that's a very subtle feature, buried 1 meter down, it would only measure 0.125 nanotesla at 2 meters down. So that same feature buried 2 meters down, that's the limit of detection. And it really, if it was even a little bit deeper than that, it's invisible. So it really is, it's not just decreasing linearly, it's decreasing exponentially. Some of the things for trying to figure out what size things are and what can be, what the size of things that can be detected, the half-width rule is one rule that we use to try to figure out how big something is based on the magnetometry data. So if you look at the magnetometry data set and you measure the anomaly, you can say that the width of that anomaly, say it's a 1 meter wide anomaly, then half of that maximum value is equal to the depth of the feature or the width, whatever is greater. So this is a pretty, it's the best thing we've got for trying to estimate the size and depth of features. And then lastly, as the feature depth increases, the change in the magnetic measurements from the maximum value outward are more gradual. What that means is that if you have a deeply buried feature, the anomaly in the data is going to be kind of more spread out because you're looking at the kind of the edge of the magnetic field and it's bigger. So it's going to be less of a discrete feature and more kind of spread out. So deeper anomalies will have widely spaced isolines, which is kind of like a contour line. So it would be a gradual change from the high value down to the low value. That would be one indication that you're looking at a deeply buried feature. Some of the disadvantages of magnetometry are, like I said before, this is always the problem, is that if you've got metal debris on the surface, like this example with the pin flags, here's one where you have a culvert going straight through the site. So when you have metal stuff and you don't want to see that stuff, then it's a problem and it's in the way. If you have igneous bedrock, then often you're not going to be able to do magnetometry at all. I was in Botswana last summer, and some of the sites were in right on top of basalt bedrock, and that's very magnetic, and so you take the instrument out and it's immediately maximized. There's no way to measure subtle archaeological features when the bedrock is generating a huge magnetic field all around you. So you really, if the bedrock is magnetic, like igneous rocks, lava, granite, andesite, then it's not going to work. Also, if you have a site where the soils are not well developed, like desert environments, you're going to get data that it's not as useful there. It still is useful, but it can be limited because soils are a big part of why magnetometry works so well. So desert environments are limited, but still it can be useful, and I'll explain that in a minute. So this data set, you've got problems here with clutter. In this data set up here, this is Tiwanaku, and that site, the bedrock is not magnetic, but much of the architecture was built by andesite, which was imported from across the lake. And so there are pieces of andesite laying all around on the surface. Sometimes it's great because you can detect, for example, this here, you see a line here, and then it bends over. So this is a sunken temple here, and it's got andesite in the wall construction, so we can see it. But all over the surface, right around here, there are pieces of andesite everywhere. So that's almost as bad as metal pin flags. They're just laying around and causing a problem. You can also see this void here where there is a wall that was constructed not of andesite. And so that one shows up because of the lack of the andesite there. Okay. My advisor, Ken Kavami, who's at the University of Arkansas, I'm sure many of you know of him, he always says that magnetometry is nature's gift to archaeology. And it's a really good way of thinking about how, because of the natural variation in the magnetic field and what humans do to the surface, it makes magnetometry particularly sensitive to what humans do, because we move stuff around, we move soil around, and we burn stuff. And so those two things leave a magnetic signature in the ground. So it seems to be that magnetometry is sort of perfectly sensitive to human patterns, what humans do to the landscape. So it's particularly sensitive to human actions. And magnetometry is the fastest geophysical method. You can cover large areas in the shortest amount of time. Especially, more and more people are using these big carts where they have many sensors mounted on one big cart, and so they're collecting multiple lines of data at once pretty rapidly. So what are the, why is it that soil is so magnetic, and why can we see it with a magnetometer? The reason is that soils, I'm not talking about just regular sediments, I'm talking about this kind of soil that you can use in your garden. It's a developed soil, and it has bacteria in it. So certain soils, there are certain microbes in the soil that are a magnetotactic bacteria, and they sequester magnetic minerals. And so they're sequestering magnetite, maghemite.
Okay, hi everyone. We're having a quick pause while we get Eileen back. So everyone just hang on for 1 second.
Can you hear me, Rachel?
Yes, I can. Okay, you are back. You just need to turn your video back on. I think we should be able to
see if I turn video on. Now, can you see my PowerPoint?
Not yet. You need to select start sharing. Okay, your PowerPoint is back, and you are good to go. Sorry about that, everyone.
I don't know when you lost me, if I need to go back a slide. Rachel, can you hear me?
Yeah, I would suggest going back one.
There's one slide, okay.
I can, and yes, I would suggest going back one slide. So you were talking about what Ken has said about magnetometry being nature's gift to archaeology, but we can hear that part again.
Okay. All right. Well, he just put it so well that it's a nice way of thinking about it, because it really is, the magnetometer is just particularly sensitive to the things that we do. And what do? We push dirt around, we dig things up, and we move soil around, and we burn things. And so through time, humans have left a signature on the landscape that is very magnetic. And so so that's one advantage of magnetometry. And it's going to rapidly cover areas, especially with these big multi-sensor carts. So I was getting into, I'm going to talk about why soil is magnetic. So magnetometry is particularly sensitive to soils. And so regions where there's lots of soil development, you're going to get better results with magnetometry often. Whereas if it was a desert environment, you have less chance of seeing subtle features unless they are burned. So with this slide here, you have this picture of a magnetotactic bacteria. So soils, as they develop, as they age, they actually become more and more magnetic, because these bacteria sequester minerals and just tend to build up over time. So the more soil, the thicker the soil, the older the soil, the richer the soil, the more magnetic it is. And so when somebody digs a hole in the ground and removes the soil, then you may have a void. Or if they mound it up, making earthen mounds, earthen structures, then you'll see a positive anomaly. So here's an example of an earth lodge. Is this the most perfect example of something that shows up really well in a magnetometer survey because of the soil property? So in this one, you have, if you take, in the case of this earth lodge, an earth lodge is built by making a structure and covering the roof with sod. So you're covering the roof with soil. And then as over time, as it's abandoned, the soil will slide down the roof and pile up in a ring. So you see this ring, and that is from that mounding up of soil in that ring pattern. So that's a really good example of the accumulation of soil. And sometimes you'll have a void where you have some incision, like tire tracks, like a game trail, or any kind of pathway, because soil has been pushed to the side, and it'll leave a void because the soil has been eroded away or pushed away. And then the other thing that humans do a lot, whether on purpose or by accident, is burn things. And anything that's been burned hot enough will show up with a magnetometer. So this is an example here. This is a house. There's some burning of the wall here and here, the pit house. And in the center is a hearth. And this is another house over here. You don't really see the walls in this data set, but the central hearth is there because it's burning in the hearth. So really great for detecting burn features. Here's another example from the same site. This is a transitional sort of Pueblo site in New Mexico. And in this case, this is a larger pit house, and these lines here are actually roof beams that burned and fell to the ground. So we did excavate and found the charred roof beams that are now laying down on the floor of the pit house. So really good resolution of these because they're burned roof beams. And then the perimeter of the house, there's a little bit of burning around the floor and the edges of it too. If you've got stone structures, so I mentioned that igneous rocks are a problem because if you've got igneous bedrock, it oversaturates the sensor and you won't be able to get any resolution of more subtle features. But if you're in a site, again, I brought up Tiwanaku again, if you're at a site where maybe the construction of stone features is using a rock that is sort of magnetic, or at least a little bit, or a lot, then you can detect it very easily because of its magnetic properties. So, you know, igneous rocks can be beneficial or a problem for magnetometry. In this case, this is some of the data at Tiwanaku, and these large anomalies here are big, large pieces of andesite. And so andesite is very magnetic, volcanic rock, and so it can be seen very easily. There's also a structure down here where it's making a sort of a rectangle, and we can even see the large chunks of andesite, which are probably big stones within the larger walls of the structure. So really great when you have a situation like that. You can have the opposite. I don't have a good example of my own data, but you can have the opposite where suppose there's a very magnetic soil, but somebody has built a structure from something like limestone, which is not magnetic at all. You would see a low magnetic anomaly where the wall is compared to the surrounding soils. So it can work both ways. Okay, moving on to ground penetrating radar. Ground penetrating radar is measuring the strength of the reflections. So you're generating, you're sending pulses of radio waves into the ground. You're measuring how long it takes for that to return back and reflect. You're measuring the strength of the reflection and how long it takes. It's measured in nanoseconds. The time is measured in nanoseconds. That's a billionth of a second. And the reflections are measured in decibels, just a measurement of their magnitude. There's the wave velocity, and I'll get into dielectric in a minute, but depending on the type of soil you're in or sediment, you can have things moving fast through the ground or slowly through the ground, so that can have an effect on it too. The relative dielectric permittivity, that's RDP, it's controlled by moisture. So this is another method that is really sensitive to moisture differences, like resistivity and conductivity. It can also be affected by the magnetic properties of the ground, but really that is not a big deal unless you have lots and lots of iron oxides in the ground. So typically, GPR is sensitive to moisture changes. The strength of the reflections that you get back depend on contrast. So it's the same thing with all these geophysical methods. You need contrast between the feature and the surrounding material. Ideal conditions for any geophysical method is a good amount of contrast, but not too much. If you have moisture throughout, then you may have too much reflection. If you get really strong reflections off of things that are shallow, then you may not see anything that's down deeper. So those are ideal conditions. So with ground penetrating radar, and I'm going to speed this up a little bit because I don't want to go too long. But this is a representation of the antenna here, and you're sending the signal in the ground. So anywhere you have contrast, anywhere you have a change, you'll get some reflection. And then you'll also get transmission. So here's some of the energy going down to the ground. Some is reflected and some continues. So you can get further and further down in the ground. Then there's scattering, so some of it reflected and you don't actually receive it. You only get back the signal that comes back in contact with the antenna, obviously. So you get, that's the general thing you're going to see when you have a change from one medium to another, you're going to see a reflection. And we don't have to go into too many details. In fact, we don't have to do this one either. Because we can, if somebody has a question about this, we can go back to that. So the way it's done is you have continuous scanning where the antenna is dragged along the ground, it's going into the ground and coming back. Usually what you get with one single line of GPR is you get a reflection profile, sometimes called a radar gram. So this is an example here. So distance, so if you were collecting this data, you would be walking along the surface here. And then this is kind of like analogous to a profile of your excavation trench. You're looking down in the ground. And so you're looking, you get much more information from GPR than with the other sensors. It's much more complicated, tons more information in that data set. Profiles are often the best source of information, but you can process it and look at it in different ways. So if you had a series of profiles, which is typical, you collect a series of them, then you can construct a 3D cube of data via interpolation. From there, then, you can look at it in three dimensions. You can do what's called an isosurface, where you make the weaker reflections transparent and try to look at just the stronger ones. Or you can do depth slices or horizontal slices and look at things as they change with depth. So GPR is the only method I'll talk about that is really a three-dimensional method that you can get different depths and see how things change with depth. So you can use different antennas. Here I have a 400 megahertz and a 270 megahertz. And there's lots of different models. I use a GSSI model, but there's a lot of different ones out there. So the things, when you choose to do a GPR survey, there's more things to consider. Choosing the instrument, choosing the antenna frequency that you're going to use, whether or not you're going to use a survey wheel like this thing here, which measures distance, or a cart, and And so you can use this wheel here. You can push it in a cart, or you can just drag it along without the wheel and keep track of distance with markers. There are a lot of things to consider because CPR is so much, there's so much more involved with it. There's a lot of things to consider with the depth and the resolution. So you consider data density. When you're going along one line, you're getting the separation between your lines is your data density in one direction. But in the other direction, along the scan, along the line, you are collecting probably, I'd usually 40 scans per meter. That's 40 points for 1 meter. Or, you know, you could do 100 per meter. So you could get a lot of data per line in radar. So it's much higher resolution, typically. And then you have to choose your time window. So how deep down do you want to look? How much time in nanoseconds are you listening for return signals? You have to consider velocity and the frequency of your antenna. All those things play into how deeply you're going to see and what kind of features you're going to resolve. One factor to consider is attenuation, and this is what everybody talks about with GPR. With attenuation, basically what's happening is your signal goes into the ground, and the ground conducts it away, and it never comes back. So attenuation is bad, and the more moisture you have in the soil, the more conduction you're going to have, the more attenuation you're going to have. So that is a problem for GPR, and so often people will say, well, there was too much clay. Clay is very conductive, and that can be a problem. If you have higher conductivity or more moisture, then you're going to have that problem. You're going to have a continuous loss as the signal goes down, no matter what, it's going to be lost and eventually diminished entirely. If it is a high conductivity medium, like wet ground, very wet ground, it's called a lossy ground, which means that it's going to lose a lot of signal. To compensate for the loss of signal, you can gain it. You can amplify it with depth, so that works pretty well. In the end, the thing with GPR is that the moisture is really the king, the really important factor. Clay minerals are also a problem, or salts. If you were in a coastal area, salts can be a problem. And in dry climates, too, where you have accumulation of salts in the soils. Clay minerals are, here's an important thing, because a lot of people say if it's a lot of clay, can't do GPR. A lot of times people don't know exactly what the clay is. It could just be very fine grain material and not actually clay minerals. And if that's the case, GPR may work just fine. It's only when you have conductive clay minerals that can cause a real problem. So I would usually try it anyway if it was a clayey material. All right, so with GPR you can choose your frequency. So another controlling factor with depth is the antenna frequency. If you want to go down deeper, you choose a lower frequency antenna. You get better depth penetration, but you lose resolution because a lower frequency antenna means a longer wavelength, so it will not be able to resolve the smaller features. If you use a higher frequency antenna, then you're going to have a shallower depth of penetration, but better resolution, typically speaking. So the rule of thumb, you will be able to detect a target that is 25% of the wavelength of your antenna, the downloaded wavelength, which it changes a little bit in the ground. So if you're using a 400 megahertz antenna, when it goes into the ground, it actually becomes about 300 megahertz. And so it changes to about a 0.75 meter long wavelength. And so your resolution of something in the ground with a 400 megahertz antenna roughly is about a quarter of a meter. So you're not going to see things smaller than that size. That's the best you're going to do. GPR antennas are broadband, so you're actually not just getting, with 400 megahertz, you're not just getting 400 megahertz energy into the ground, you're getting a whole spectrum. So there's that too. The lower frequency antenna, the 270, is really good for deeper targets. And it's been very successful at many sites. And then you can go up a 900 megahertz. I mean, there's all different frequencies. These are ones that I have used that can be good for really small stuff. But it also has its limitations, too. Ultimately, for GPR, it's the ground conditions, depth penetration with the ground moisture. And so you've got to choose the right antenna. I think I'm going to skip the depth basically the idea of this is that your ability to see in the ground is also limited by the properties of the soil. So something like dry sand has a low RDP, which means the waves will travel fast and they won't be attenuated. So that's the gist of that there, is the different types of materials in the ground are going to affect the data. So the disadvantages of ground penetrating radar, I probably could have spent an hour on radar because it's so complex. There's so many factors to understand. Very complex learning curve. I spent a couple of years just focused on GPR before I learned any of the other methods. It's more time consuming to collect, to process, to interpret. Everything is more detailed. Potentially you get more out of it, but it's a bigger effort overall. The advantages are sometimes it's the only method that works. So I always try all my methods and often one or two out of three or four will work well. Sometimes I've been at sites where it is absolutely the best and the only reason why we even understand the site. So it can be a really great method. You can also use it. It is the only instrument that you can use in an urban environment. You can go right over the pavement, over a parking lot, over stone pavers. So in urban settings, it's your only option to see beneath pavements and things like that. And it's not going to have a problem with metal debris and things like that. If you have sheet metal, yes, because sheet metal under the ground or something very big will reflect all the energy and you won't see beneath it. But little bit of metal here and there are not going to overwhelm the sensor. And it's the only method that gives you depth. So you can measure how deep something is once you estimate your depth of penetration. And you can look at things in discrete depth intervals, and you can even get the three-dimensional sort of geometry of features with GPR. So it's really powerful, but a much steeper learning curve. Okay. It is exactly 2 o'clock, and so I have not been good about looking at the chat. I see the last question said, what is the influence of metal on magnetic susceptibility? Bob, metal on magnetic susceptibility is a problem, but not nearly as much with a magnetometer. So if you're thinking about if you're thinking about if you have a site that has lots of metal debris and you wanted to do magnetometer, it probably would not work so well. But with magnetic susceptibility with an EM instrument, it may not be a problem. You'll see tiny little blips from these metal debris, metal clutter, but it will be a minor signal. So I will use an EM instrument in areas that the magnetometer doesn't work so well. Katie says, are there central sources you could recommend that have a variety of images showing various types of signatures, such as examples, common utilities or debris one might encounter, or common site types? Are you referring to something like NADAG, or? I'm not sure what you mean by that. Oh, so you don't have a mic, Katie. Katie doesn't have a mic, but she's asking for where to look at. NADAG is out of date, but the North American Database of Archaeological Geophysics is a repository of imagery showing a variety of what types of features you can see with different sensors. So examples all over North America. It's focused on North America. Otherwise, you can really browse the literature. I do have some case studies to show, but I didn't have time to get into them. But I would look online and I would read papers that show, sites. If you are thinking about doing geophysics, we want to talk to an expert, and you want to look at the literature for similar sites and somebody that's done geophysics there. If anyone has a question, I think you can turn your mic on, or you can type in a chat question.
Okay, so we'll just give everyone a couple minutes to formulate their questions. I think you got through a lot of material, so everyone is probably thinking a bit. So I have one question, I guess, kind of along the similar lines to Katie. So if you're looking to get started in archaeological geophysics, do you have like a single basic textbook or something that you would recommend people start off with at the very beginning?
The most intro level one that's really good is Gaffney and Gator, and it is, I think it's focused, I think they wrote it for undergraduates, so it's very general, it's a very good introductory, and it has all sorts of good examples, and it's 5 or 6 years old now. I let a student borrow it, so I don't have it on my bookshelf, but I don't remember the title, so I'd have to look it up. But it's Gaffney and Gator are the authors from Bradford University. I have a whole list of books just on ground-penetrating radar. Larry Conyers has two books, and he has another one in press right now. His book, Ground-Penetrating Radar in Archaeology, is still the standard, and it's in his third edition. So that one is really great for ground-penetrating radar. For other methods, the classic reference on magnetometry and resistivity would be, let me get it off myself here, Anthony Clark. And this one is still, it's kind of old, but it's still one of my favorites because it goes over all the basics. Anthony Clark, Seeing Beneath the Soil. This one, it's 96 or 98, so it is a little bit out of date. Looking on my bookshelf. I am a radar person, so this is my favorite radar book, Larry Conyers' new radar book on ground-penetrating radar interpretation. So if you're getting into radar, this is a really great one because he gives all examples of all the pitfalls and all the things that can happen when you're trying to interpret ground-penetrating radar data. I have given out all of my other books to my students. Here's Gaffney and Gator. There it is. Gaffney and Gator's Revealing the Buried Past. This one is really great for introductory. And I also have, it's gray literature. What I have is a manual. It's called a guidance document. And if you go to my CASC page, I have a link to a document that was written for government officials. It was written for the Department of Defense. As part of a grant, and it runs through all the methods of what they're used for, a lot what I just presented today, so not as many examples. For examples, you got to browse the literature for a lot of examples, I think.
Okay, so thanks, Eileen, for all of that information. We've got another question. Any good references for using an EM38 MK2?
So Katie just reminded me the Jay Johnson volume on remote sensing in archaeology, an explicitly North American perspective. That one is an excellent one for North American archaeology. And there are a couple chapters in there. There's one chapter on magnetic susceptibility and one on conductivity. But they are not, I don't have any books that have a really good, thorough background on EM, which is what Bob just asked, any good references for using an EM38 MK2. I would look, the EM38 MK2 is, and all the EM38 series, the Geonix EM38 and various iterations of that instrument, is not really widely used yet, so you don't see as many papers on it. I use it and I love it, but for a long time I think archaeologists were using it only to measure conductivity, and then they started noticing that the magnetic susceptibility component was useful too. So I would look in the literature for that because I have not seen specific publications on the EM38. There is a book in progress right now, which is a follow-up to that, the North American Perspective, edited by Jay Johnson. and that will probably have a more updated sort of overview of all the methodologies. And I imagine there'll be something in there about the EM38, but I think that's another year or two before that'll be published. So in the meantime, I would go for the published papers and journal articles.
Okay, great. So are there any other questions from the group? We can hang out for a couple more minutes. And if there isn't anything or while people are thinking, I'll just say that we do generally try and post these talks and so a recording of the audio and the slides where possible on the Spark website on the webinars page. So keep an eye out for that. That should happen within the next week or so. And that will be there for you as a reference. And otherwise, I just want to thank Eileen again for talking to us today and thank all of you for coming. And hopefully we will see many of you at our next webinar or hear from you applying in the next round of projects with all the information you've learned about geophysical survey here today. And I'll just remind everyone that our next deadline for applications for projects is December 15th. So you've got a little while to think about things and learn more about geophysics before applying, but it is coming up.
And for anyone looking to browse through articles, there are a lot of places, but one kind of clearinghouse of archaeological geophysics is the journal Archaeological Prospection, which all the papers in there are archaeological geophysics, pretty much. So a really good source for looking at what's happening in the latest methods. Thank you all for logging in.
Okay, that's it. Bye, everyone.